For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week I've been out and about celebrating books while producer Robert Kirkwood has been busy in the studio. I report from the party where the shortlist for this year's Booker Prize was announced.
I have my own very personal rule about what happens when the longlist comes out. I read the longest book on the longlist first.
Chris McQueer tells Robert Kirkwood how he started writing.
But being quite fed up with the kind of situation I was in, I thought, like, writing kind of gives me something to do in it. Gets me at my own head for a wee while, so sat down and I wrote a wee story. I thought, oh, this is great fun. I wish I'd done this a lot sooner.
Mary Beard talks about history books and contemporary politics.
Partly I find I take the Guardian live feed as if it's a novel, you know, it's what happens next.
And we hear some familiar voices enjoying the audiobook workers' picnic. That's all coming up on today's Read On. First awarded in 1969, the Booker Prize celebrates the finest fiction written in the English language. It's open to books published in the UK and Ireland by authors from across the world. The list of former winners includes many of the literary giants of the last four decades, from Iris Murdoch to Salman Rushdie, Ian McEwan to Hilary Mantel. The shortlist of the six novels in contention for this year's Booker Prize was announced at a sparkling party held in the Serpentine Gallery in London's Hyde Park, and I was lucky enough to attend. Thanks to a long-standing arrangement with RNIB, the Booker Prize Foundation has again funded production of Braille, giant print and talking book versions of all the shortlisted titles, ensuring that members of the RNIB library can join in the discussion. Eve Smith from the Booker Foundation told me more.
It's something that's very important to us. We've been doing it for a long time now. And there's a recognition that everybody is entitled to share in the discussion and the debate around the prizes. And so, although there is one big challenge as far as conversion into accessible formats is concerned this year, with a 998-page book as one of the shortlists, it's a very exciting year again, and we're very pleased to be able to support the RNIB. I have my own very personal rule about what happens when the longlist comes out. I read the longest book on the longlist first. And that's partly just to make sure that I can do it, that I leave myself enough time. But it's always interesting because most long books have a very particular sort of construction around them. They are very formal. They're not just streams of consciousness. And even though, you know, James Joyce is described as a book about the consciousness of what happens in a single day, it's very, very, very carefully structured, as is Duck's Newburyport in this particular list. So I'm hoping it's quite exciting for you to be able to listen to it, to be able to read it in Braille, to be able to see it in giant print, whatever it is, that you, the way in which you access it.
Yes, I think it's definitely a book you need to dive into, and as with a lot of things you need to dive into, sometimes you need a guide, and I think a good narrator will make it a fantastic book. As with last year with Washington Black, which just rose off the page with the narration that you were able to fund for us.
Oh, that's it's always interesting to hear, and it's always interesting to see what really appeals when we sort of get the feedback about who's been reading what, you know, how many people have read these things, and I think it's just so important that, because there is a visual impairment, it doesn't mean you're excluded for a conversation. We do work with other excluded sort of cohorts, if you like, to make sure that everyone can be involved in talking about what is good literature and what is making news at the moment.
Well, and the figures seem to show it, that there are more people downloading the books that are on the shortlist for the Booker Prize each year from the library, because they don't feel excluded. They do feel part of the conversation, and the books are there.
It's interesting. I'm taking my hat off to everyone that's involved at the RNIB, because it, you know, it's a big ask to actually get these books into the formats up and running so everyone can feel that they can participate. So all credit to you for actually sort of taking on the challenge. It's one thing to provide the funding, it's another thing to actually carry it out.
I think it's the 16th year that we've been working together.
It sounds about right. Yeah.
And long may it continue. Have you read all the books?
I haven't yet read all the books on the long list. I'm not a judge. That's not necessarily sort of my job to read them, but as soon as the long list comes out, I begin to work my way through. And it's always interesting when you get to shortlist phase to see what you've read and what you haven't read and what you think you're going to read next. And it's an interesting year with two former winners, as well as some very, very new voices, although many of the voices that are on the list are already well known and well recognised. We've got one former shortlistee. We've got people like Bernardine Evaristo, who is very well known. But to set up a conversation between those six authors is very interesting. It really is. We've been talking a lot internally about what it is that the prize does, and there is a lot of discussion about who's eligible, who's not eligible, and about formats. But what the prize is doing is reflecting the fact that there are some very interesting sort of movements in the way that long form fiction is developing. So last year we had a novel that was essentially a poem, Robin Robertson. This year we have, again, a book of great poetry. We have things which are actually driving forward what readers sort of can engage with in terms of form and format. And also we've got some thumping good reads, you know, which anyone will recognise as being what they want. But I think it prizes for readers. That's what it's for. It's for people who read. It's, yes, it rewards authors, it rewards publishers, but the people we're worried about are the people who actually read.
Do you think that in 5 years' time you might actually have an audiobook specialist on the panel of judges?
Well, never say never, and it's an interesting concept, and the role of the audio engagement with books is something that's very much on our minds at the moment, but we haven't got any specific plans about it. But it is something that we are quite interested in, and the way in which people engage with literature is no longer just sitting down with a book as an artifact. That's important to a lot of people, but there are all sorts of other ways that people engage with stories and engage with literature. So who knows.
Well, Eve Smith, thank you again for ensuring that print disabled book lovers can access all the books on the Booker shortlist, and for taking some time out from the party to talk to RNIB Connect Radio.
It's a huge pleasure. I'm very pleased to have been able to speak to you again. Thank you.
And we'll have more from the Booker Prize party later in the show. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, a picnic in the park with some familiar voices, and Mary Beard on history books and contemporary politics. But first, Chris McQueer is the author of two short story collections, Hings and HWFG. He's recently recorded them both as commercial audiobooks, which will be available soon. And he told Robert Kirkwood all about them.
Twitter jail is a very real thing. This is a fact I learned, much to my surprise. I never thought I, of all people, would ever end up there, but sadly, a wee while ago, I did. After watching the football one Thursday night with my pal, I got a bit steaming. Anyone with a Twitter account will tell you that tweeting while steaming is a recipe for disaster. It's such a truly bad idea that it can, and will, ruin your entire life. I started writing, I think, 2016, I think. How old was I? 24, going on 25. I'd always wanted to be a writer. I'd always wanted to have a go at writing. But for some reason, it took me until being 24, 25 to finally get my finger out and do something about it. And it was just a case of like being quite fed up with the kind of situation I was in. I thought, like, writing kind of gives me something to do, and it gets me out of my own head for a wee while. So I sat down and I wrote a wee story, and I thought, oh, this is great fun. Like, I wish I'd done this a lot sooner. And then I started putting my stories online. I was getting my pals to read it, I was getting my family to read it, and then they were sharing it with their pals, and I built up a wee following as a result of that. And then eventually, kind of publisher 404 Inc. kind of took notice, and then that was it. All my wee stories get put into a book, and it's been brilliant. It's been just a cracking couple of years since, so long may it continue, hopefully.
And your new book, we can't say the full title on
aye.
Air.
HWFG. Aye, aye.
You just recorded that within the RNIB Talking Book Studios. How was that?
It was great fun, really great fun. I really wanted to like record the books as audiobooks, but it's kind of out with your hands as a writer, do you know what I mean? It's all stuff that kind of goes on behind the scenes that you don't really have much of a say in. So when I finally got the go-ahead that I was going to get to do it, I was so chuffed. And like, especially with HWFG, because a lot of the stories I write, I kind of write them to be read out. You know, I do a lot of kind of spoken word stuff, so I write a lot of stuff to be read out. So getting to record all the stories in the book as an audiobook was great fun, and hope people enjoy it. Hope you like listening to my dulcet tones.
A lot of the times the books are given over to actors to read. Could you imagine anyone else doing it other than you?
I don't know. I think when I get told Audible are interested, I kind of assumed they would want somebody else to read them. I felt like I wouldn't have much say in the matter, but I wasn't quite sure about it. Once I got the go-ahead that I was able to read it out, I was so chuffed. It's just brilliant getting back to these stories that I wrote, kind of bringing them to life, I think. I don't know, as I'm reading it out, I'm kind of thinking, you know, what's this character got to sound like? You know, what kind of voice am I going to do for them? There's one of the stories that had a Cockney guy in it, and I was like, oh no, I'm going to do a Cockney accent here. So we'll see if that makes the final cut.
They're written in your voice, your own voice and your dialect. How are they received outside Scotland?
They're no, like, no massively successful outside of Scotland. It's a bit of a hard sell, but I think like the people that have read them down south and stuff, like I think you do tune into Scots if you're not a kind of native Scots speaker. You do tune into it quite quickly. It's got a nice rhythm to it, and it's just trying to nail that rhythm when you're writing it so people out with Scotland can understand it. But I think once you do that, like, once people give it a chance and read it, you know, it's not a totally foreign language, you know, it's just Scots, we're just fair up the road, so just give it a go. Like,
The Guardian described you as Charlie Brooker on Buckfast. Is that fair?
I was all the men with that. So I quite like it. I like the idea of kind of Buckfast fueled Charlie Brooker, because he writes some pretty wild stuff. So to be compared to him, but with a wee extra edge, was quite nice.
There's also comparisons to Irvine Welsh as well.
I quite like that as well, but at the same time, That was the kind of quote that was on the cover of the first book. And that, to me, when I seen it at first, I was like, oh, that's amazing being compared to my hero. But then straight away it felt like a kind of weight on my shoulders, a kind of expectation on me now. I was like, oh, people are going to buy that, reading that quote, expecting me to be exactly like Irvine Welsh. And I was like, oh, no, I don't know if I like that. But then also, like, I don't really want to be like kind of bracketed in.
Yes.
With other writers, I'd like to kind of forge my own path. And I'd just like to be known for my own writing instead of kind of comparisons with other Scottish writers. I think that tends to happen, like kind of Scottish writers get kind of lumped in together. Do you know what I mean? So I'd like to try and break away from that, but that's still nice. I'm still flattered.
Now, you say you do a lot of spoken word performances. What's your favourite stories to read out?
I always do. There's one for Hings which is called Comma Police, which is about a world where chicken commas have been banned. You know what I mean? Because people always laugh at chicken commas, and I thought, well, you know, what would happen if they were just outlawed altogether, and the comma police are going about and they're enforcing this rule. I like reading that out, because there's a lot of kind of like guns and stuff in it. I like doing the actions and the shooting and the banging in doors and stuff. It's quite good. The ones I like reading out the most are like the wee kind of shorter stories, like ones that are maybe a page and a half, two or three pages long, that end on a wee punchline. So they're quite good, because it almost feels like you're doing a stand-up routine, you know, and you're priming people and you're getting them ready for the big punchline at the end. It's good fun. You know what I mean? When I do that, I feel like Billy Connor or something. It's amazing. I love it so much.
And they're standalone stories, but there are recurring characters in them all, especially. So they are kind of interlinked.
Aye. I like to imagine that they all take place in the kind of the same universe. And I like kind of like bringing characters back. You know, I started doing that because I had a wee bit of writer's block after the first book, and I was, you know, you're trying to come up with a whole new cast of characters and settings and places. And then I thought, like, I'll try and write another story about a character called Sammy in the first book. I'll try and write another story about him, and I found like it was just so much easier because I knew this wee guy, that I knew this character, and story just came out about him. And I was like, all right, cool. Well, oh, that works. I'm going to put that in the next book. And it got me thinking, you know, who else did I like for the first book? Or there's a character called Big Angie. I'll write another one about her. And then it just kind of went for there. I like the idea that I can kind of start laying wee threads between all my stories and start building up this wee world and building up wee connections and let readers try and figure them out and try and figure out how other stories are linked.
Now, there's a bonus story at the end of Here We Go.
Aye.
About you being in Twitter jail. That is based on a real incident.
Aye, that's true. Aye, it's a real incident. Aye. Basically, I was on holiday a couple of years ago, and it was with my ex-girlfriend at the time. And while we were on holiday, this French footballer tried to chat her up online. And I was like, wow, this is insane. But like, I never really thought anything of it until about a week later. I was back home and I was in the pub with my pal, and I was telling him about it after a couple of pints. And he was like, you should say something. And I was like, full of bravado. I was like, right, I'm going to say something. So I found the guy on Twitter. I told him I was going to kill him. a completely calm and measured response. Anyway, I didn't think anything of it, went to bed, woke up, tried to log into Twitter, found out my account had been suspended. I was placed in Twitter jail, unfortunately. And then that just, wee things like that just spark off ideas for stories for me, you know. I was thinking, like, what if Twitter jail is a real place? What if I did actually get the jail? What if there was a kind of tweet wing in Berlin, you know, like, what if? I'm frog marched through to another part of the jail by the guy. He doesn't say a word. A couple of times he pushes me in the back so I stumble forward and he laughs. He even clips my heels a few times so I fall over. Who's this? A bearded guard asks, waiting at the end of the corridor. Chris McQueer, the guy says. Take up me the tweet wing, Frank. Tweet wing? I laugh. This is a bam up, eh? A fist hurtles into my ribs. Less of your the bearded says. I've seen you on that Twitter. You damn a f***, he'd write in. Oh, look at me, I've wrote a wee book, please buy it. You make me sick. I get to my feet, holding my side. It feels like it's on fire. These lads know how to fling a punch.
Now, that's both your books recorded and available in audio. Is that important to you that now anyone can access them?
That is definitely. I did a reading about 18 months ago and it was in the Mitchell Library. There was a group of three visually impaired people there and they were asking me, you know, they said, you know, they like coming to hear me perform my work.
Mm.
So is there an audiobook in the works kind of thing? And at the time there wasn't, but that straight away I was like, I felt quite bad that there wasn't. But then after that, like, the ball started rolling with Audible and stuff, and I'm really, really glad that now the books are accessible for a lot more people. Really chuffed, really glad.
Thanks to Robert and to Chris McQueer. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, I spend an afternoon in the park with a party of narrators. And the man who bought us Mr. Gum shares the books of his life. But before that, Dame Mary Beard is Britain's best-known classicist. Through her work as a writer and broadcaster, she's popularised interest in ancient Greece and Rome and uses it to shed light on current affairs. She's also a keen follower of contemporary arts. So it was a pleasure to bump into her at the party for the announcement of this year's Booker Prize shortlist.
Have you read any of the books on the Booker shortlist this year?
Terrible confession, isn't it? I started Bernardine Evaristo, and I'm looking forward to reading the Margaret Atwood, but you can't read it yet. And I suppose, you know, that's everybody's looking forward to reading the Margaret Atwood, but can't read it yet. And the others I haven't read, but maybe there's still time.
Although there are an awful lot of pages to get through.
There are an awful lot of pages, and the girl's got other things to read. And I've never been one that says, and I know there are people like this, who say, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to read the whole Booker shortlist. And I think that's a bit nerdy.
What do you read for pleasure?
That's quite hard to say, because my whole life is spent reading, and it is quite pleasurable, you know, actually. And I read quite a lot of non-fiction for pleasure. At the moment, I mean, I'm about to do another series of our television culture programme, Front Row Late. And that's great fun for me, because it pushes me away from the classics and it pushes me away from non-fiction. And we've got a great episode, which is about memoirs and autobiography, thinking about the future. Cameron, I mean, very soon to be with us, autobiography. None of us have seen it because you can't see it, but we're having a programme which is wondering about how memoirs operate, how we believe them, what the first person is. And, of course, these kind of programmes are a wonderful excuse, because you can say, right, I'm working now, and go to bed with a pile of books you wouldn't usually read. And I'm just in the middle of Satnam Sangera's Boy with the Top Knot, which I'm much, much enjoying. Wonderful. But I've also been kind of scanning our shelves and going back to other memoirs that I kind of enjoy, like, you know, Ons and Rebels by Jessica Mitford. Wow, that's good. So you meet me on a day when I'm just going to... I'm not reading anything other than autobiography.
I wonder whether you think that it is a curse to live in interesting times. We're clearly going through some of the most interesting political times that we've had in, well, two or three generations. And yet everybody here seems excited as well as nervous.
Yes, it's odd, isn't it? And partly I find I take the sort of Guardian Live feed as if it's a novel, you know, is what happens next. And yet I think I'm slightly suspicious about the kind of category of interesting times, because I think probably everybody's times are interesting in a way. I think it's a bit easy to fall into the idea that, you know, governmental meltdown makes the country interesting. I mean, it certainly makes the news interesting, but that's a different matter. Although we also know that there are quite a lot of people who are just fed up with all this. So, there, you know, I think the country divides really between those like me who can barely put their mobile phone down in case another Tory MP has crossed the floor of the House, you know, and those who think, oh, for crying out loud.
What do you think will be the more enduring, the fiction written about the years after Brexit or the biography?
Really interesting, because one of the things that I've been thinking about for this programme about memoirs and thinking about, you know, quotes, the interesting times we're living in, and I don't know about fiction, but I kind of started to think, whose account would you want to have of it? You know, whose account? And I think that's really, really hard. I know that I don't want Boris Johnson's account, but where is that brilliantly observant, wry take going to be? Which of our present politicians, who are probably slightly on the margins of the centre of power, which of them are keeping a diary with that sort of sharp acuity which will one day become, you know, the Samuel Pepys of the 21st century?
Meanwhile, are you working on another book yourself, and could you ever be tempted to write fiction yourself?
I'm working on a book about images of Roman emperors in Renaissance and later art, and that sounds deeply, deeply learned and nerdy, but actually it's hugely fun, and there's, you can't imagine the odd and weird versions of Roman emperors that artists have produced since the 15th century, you know, in waxworks, as ink pots, you know, just amazing, you know, as well as all those kind of busts lined up. And it's just tremendously interesting thinking about why on earth anybody wants to do it. You know, here you've got, I'm looking at the first 12 Roman emperors, and, you know, all but one had allegations that they were murdered. Most of them are pretty unsavoury, if you believe what's written about them. So it's actually thinking, you know, what is this kind of collection of semi-criminals that has become so, particularly was, and it still is to some extent, so prominent in Western culture. So that's good fun. I've nearly finished it. But fiction, and what I like about non-fiction is there is a framework there. I know you have to construct it yourself. You can't, you know, you can't just sit there and say, oh well, I'm just going to tell the story, because the story is what you create. But I really admire a novelist, the idea that you kind of sit down and you really have got a blank piece of paper, and you know, you can do a whole lot. You can go to the library and you can find out what life was like in 17th century Paris or whatever, you know, and, you know, you can do research. But actually, you're on your own, mate. And I never feel quite that I'm on my own. So I think it'd be a long time before I venture into fiction, although some people might say that some of the things I've already written about the Romans might be fiction. Who knows?
And do you ever listen to your books as audiobooks, or are you a print fan?
No, I don't listen to them, but two of the shorter ones, I've done the recording for the audiobook. For the longer ones, I didn't. And I found doing the recordings of it absolutely fascinating. You know, I think that, I mean, everybody should actually read out their own book as if to an audiobook before they send it to the printers. You know, because you read it out and you think, has, you know, not that it's wrong, but, you know, you notice an awkward repetition between one sentence and the next that you like to think that you've caught when you're print reading, but you always miss some. And you can tell the bits that are good because they become quite easy to read. Whereas when you find yourself stumbling, that's probably because it's not very well written. So I found doing the reading, I can't quite bear to listen to them. I mean, I think it'd be kind of very odd, but it's certainly been really, really, it's been an eye-opener doing it.
And finally, what is your rainy day book, your book to curl up with as comfort food when you've got, well, nothing else to do, which I doubt happens very often?
It doesn't happen very often. I mean, if there's a kind of book of a lifetime, it's Jane Eyre, I suppose. And not actually because I think it's, you know, it's not my number one. If I was going to say, let's think about great novels, you know, it'd be somewhere there, but it's not. I'm not overclaiming for it. It's just that it was a novel that I read when I was little, and then read again and read again, and you know, you sort of mark your own growing up and change by the different way you take it. You know, I used to think, oh, if only I could marry Mr. Rochester, right? Well, you know, now I think, what a stupid thing, eh?
Well, Mary Beard, thank you so much. I shall let you get on and enjoy the party, and thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you, it's been great.
Pompeii, the life of a Roman town, by Mary Beard. In the early hours of the 25th of August, 79 CE, the rain of pumice falling on Pompeii was easing off. It seemed a good moment to leave the city and make a bid for safety. A struggling group of more than 20 fugitives, who had been taking shelter within the walls while the dreadful downpour had been at its worst, took a chance on one of the eastern gates of the city, hoping to find a way out of range of the volcanic bombardment. A few others had tried this route some hours before. One couple had fled, carrying just a small key. They presumably hoped one day to return to whatever it locked, house, apartment, chest, or strongbox, and a single bronze lamp. This can hardly have made much impact against the darkness of the night and the clouds of debris, but it was an expensive and fashionable object, moulded in the shape of a black African head, a hint of the, to us, disconcerting forms of ingenuity we shall often come across in Pompeii. The pair didn't make it. Overwhelmed by the pumice, they were found in 1907 where they had fallen, next to one of the grand tombs which lined this road, like others, out of the city. They collapsed, in fact, next to the lavish memorial to a woman who had died perhaps 50 years before, Aesquilia Polla, the wife of Numerius Herennius Celsus. Just 22 years old, as we can still read on the stone, she must have been less than half the age of her rich husband, a member of one of Pompeii's most prominent families, who had served as an officer in the Roman army and had twice been elected to the highest office in the city's local government.
Pompeii by Mary Beard is available in Braille and as TB16535. It's narrated by Michael Tudor Barnes.
I'm Lynn Livingston, Book Collection Development Assistant in the RNIB Library, and I'd just like to tell you about some exciting new books in the Talking Book Library. First up, The Single Ladies of the Jacaranda Retirement Village by Joanna Nell. The life of 79-year-old pensioner Peggy Smart is as beige as the decor in her retirement village. Her week revolves around aqua aerobics and appointments with her doctor. The highlight of Peggy's day is watching her neighbour Brian head out for his morning swim. Peggy dreams of inviting the handsome widower to an intimate dinner, but why would an educated man like Brian look twice at Peggy? As a woman of a certain age, she fears she has become invisible, even to men in their 80s. But a chance encounter with an old school friend she hasn't seen in 5 decades, the glamorous fashionista Angie Valentine, sets Peggy on an unexpected journey of self-discovery. Can she channel her inner Helen Mirren and find love and friendship in her twilight years?
Peggy Smart was 90% sure it was Monday. She squinted at the days printed on her medication pack. What an ingenious invention. Thanks to the individual bubbles, she never forgot to take her pills. And more importantly, she never missed Brian.
Next, we have one for the thrill seekers. A Damned Serious Business by Gerald Seymour. There is a new Cold War raging, and its frontline warriors are Russian hackers. These are gang members working freelance for the FSB, the successor to the KGB, causing massive thefts of personal information and electoral interference. Edwin Coker is a case officer at the Vauxhall headquarters of MI6. When a young hacker falls into his hands and reveals details of a secret meeting, Coker conceives a daring plan to strike back, not with a computer virus of his own, but with a bomb that will seriously damage the Russian operation, spreading fear and distrust. Now he needs a deniable handler to deliver the explosives across the border from Estonia into Russia and bring the hacker back out. They turn to Merck, an ex-soldier fighting in Iraq, a gun for hire who knows how to get out of a tight spot. But from the moment Merck sets out to cross the River Narva, things do not go to plan. Gerald Seymour is rightly considered one of the best thriller writers in the world, and A Damn Serious Business sees him once again at the top of his game.
Boot had flown to Stockholm the previous evening, had booked into an old city hotel with a tariff above the normal service allowance, but the maid, who ran his affairs at VBX, had stated, "Cross my heart and hope to die," that nothing cheaper had available rooms. A good woman, the maid, and part of a loyal team that supported Boot. But until he had the target beside him and had put forward the proposition, he would not know whether the optimism was justified.
And finally, we have the seventh book in the crime series featuring forensic archaeologist Dr. Ruth Galloway. The Ghost Fields by Ellie Griffiths won the 2016 CWA Dagger in the Library Award for Best Crime Book. Norfolk is experiencing a July heatwave when a construction crew unearths a macabre discovery, a buried World War II plane with a pilot still inside. DCI Harry Nelson calls forensic archaeologist Ruth Galloway to investigate, and she quickly realizes that the skeleton couldn't possibly be the pilot. Then DNA tests identify the man as Fred Blackstock, a local aristocrat who has been reported dead at sea. When the remaining members of the Blackstock family learn about the discovery, they seem strangely frightened by the news. Events are further complicated by a TV company that wants to make a film about Norfolk's deserted Air Force bases, the so-called Ghost Fields, which have been partially converted into a pig farm run by one of the younger Blackstocks. As production begins, Ruth notices a mysterious man lurking close to the Blackstock's family home. Then human bones are found in the family's pig farm. And if you enjoy that book, you can go back and start at the beginning of the Ruth Galloway series and read them all. Happy reading.
Barry climbs into the cab and gets a spade. The ground is hard, but the earth moves fairly easily. Barry labours away, his t-shirt sticking to his back, until he reaches something else, something even bigger. Breathing heavily, he puts the spade down and wipes away soil with his hands. Then he encounters something that isn't metal. It's glass, clogged with dirt, and almost opaque. But Barry, driven by something which he doesn't quite understand, clears a space so that he can peer through. A scream makes the seagulls rise into the air. It is a few seconds before Barry realizes that he was the one who had screamed. And he almost does so again as he stumbles away from the buried giant. Because, when he looked through the window, someone was looking back at him.
Something for everyone there, thanks to Lynn Livingston. For more information, go to the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. Now, before we go to Andy Stanton to hear the books of his life, on a sunny Sunday in September, I ventured down to Regent's Park in London for the inaugural Audiobook Workers' Picnic. Though the park was crowded, one group of revellers appeared to be in finer voice than the rest. Guided by their voices, I found some old friends. First among them, David Thorpe, who helped organise the event.
Right, I am a member of the Audiobook Working Party, the Equity, the Entertainment Workers Trade Union. I have an audiobook working party who look at all issues relating to audiobooks. And probably a couple of years ago now, we had a meeting which various narrators came to. And someone said, wouldn't it be nice to do something informal, get everyone together, have a bit of something like a picnic? And so this year, we finally got ourselves together and organised a picnic, and this is it. It's been very well attended, I'm delighted to say, not only by narrators, it's been open to everyone. There have been producers are here, we've got people from the admin staff working on audiobooks, we've got an agent, all sorts of people have come along. Basically, I've just stuck an Equity flag in a tree, and they've come. Yeah, so that's how it came about.
How many years have you been a narrator?
When I began narrating audiobooks, it was onto a steam cassette. I've been doing them now since the early or mid-1990s, I think. 95, something like that, 1995. Yes, and they genuinely were onto reel-to-reel tape, because I started at the RNIB and still read at the RNIB, but that's, they were on tape, and it's all digital now.
I actually recognise quite a lot of the voices round here. It does seem that RNIB has been the centre of excellence that has populated the now very popular audiobook world.
So true. Looking around, there are a lot of narrators here, many, many of who started out at the RNIB. Yeah, definitely.
For anybody who wants to pick up a great audiobook, what have you worked on lately that's really stuck out for you?
I've thought of a lovely book, and I've forgotten the name of the writer, so you'll have to look that up, but it's called Something to Live For. That's one that I've done that I've really, really enjoyed. I did a very interesting book for RNIB about a cyclist who I'd never heard of, I'm ashamed to say, called Fausto Coppi, which I've just finished. Italian cyclist, amazing, I mean, brilliant, genius sportsman, but also an amazing sort of life, because, well, I don't want to spoil it for you, but he had an affair with a woman at a time when adultery was illegal in Italy, and that was, that's an amazing book. It's called Fallen Angel.
So here's another voice that I recognise from the RNIB studios. Lucy, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, hello, I'm Lucy Scott. I often read for the RNIB. In fact, I'm about to go in 2 weeks' time to read a lovely novel called, by Lucy Mallinson called Threepenny. Oh, God, I'll have to look it up. But it's a sort of an autobiography. She was a thriller writer in the First World War. So it's quite unusual for a woman to be writing thrillers then. So she wrote under a pseudonym, Anthony Gilbert, I think her name was. His name.
Gender is very fluid in the 21st century, well, and clearly was in the 20th.
Yes, obviously.
Can you remember the first book that you did for the RNIB?
I can't remember the title, but I do remember it was in Great Portland Street before it moved to Camden. And I remember clearly I had an engineer called Peter, who's subsequently left, and he was so helpful. Because I just turned up with all these sort of accents and energy, and I thought, this is what you want. And actually he said, no, whoa, calm down and allow the story to take over. You know, just give a little flavour to all the characters and disappear into the background and allow... And that was such good advice. And so I always think of him when I'm sort of preparing a book, especially a kid's book, actually. You do need a bit more energy, but not so much. So, yes, it was a sort of children's book, the first one. Really enjoyed it. And there were two studios for one engineer. So it wasn't great time keeping, if you see what I mean. So if the other reader mucked up, and the engineer was dealing with them, you would just have to wait. So, and you're only really paid for the time that you actually record. So, it wasn't ideal. So Camden is brilliant. It's really good.
And could you ever have imagined that audiobooks would have become as successful as they are now?
Well, I'm so pleased that it is a successful, because I've always loved audio. I'll always listen to audio myself. I mean, it's theatre for one, isn't it? It's absolutely, and it takes you off into another world. So I've loved it. I couldn't really understand why anyone else wouldn't, but God bless technology for being able to make it so easy to download and to, you know, sit on a train or go for a walk and listen. I mean, it's It's wonderful, and I'm so delighted. I mean, personally as well, just because there's just more work around. So I love it. Love audiobooks.
And final question. I heard you and David talking a little bit earlier about a favourite audiobook that you've got at the moment.
David showed me a book that he'd recorded, and I listened to it, and I was bowled over. It was called Stumm, and it was, I thought it was actually true, but he said it was based on somebody's life, so it is a piece of fiction, but it's set during the Second World War, and it's about a Jewish family, and I was blubbing at the end, and David did just an amazing, amazing job. Really wonderful. All the characters, well, you know, he gave them all a flavour, but my goodness, they leapt out. It was wonderful.
My name is Catherine Fenton. I've been narrating audiobooks for 16 years. I'm an American. I love narrating audiobooks because for me, it's a little bit like taking one art form and transposing it into another art form. And I love the responsibility that comes with that and the challenges that come with that. Love being able to tell stories. I feel very lucky to do this as my job.
And is there a book that's really stood out for you that you've narrated that just clicked with you?
Do you know, I there are several, and there are books that are very important to me because they are important books, and those are always a privilege to read. So if you read a classic, for example, or you read something that's very... I read The Shock Doctrine at the RNIB, and I love doing that one because it's such an important book. And then there are others that really appeal personally because they're just so exquisite. So at the moment I'm doing a Renée Denfield book called The Butterfly Girl, and I read her previous book, The Child Finder, and I find her work so tender and clever and painful and brave. And so whenever I get one of her titles, then I'm always very happy.
And is there a book that you would push all the other narrators out of the way to get your hands on and narrate?
Gosh, I don't know at the moment. No, I would say no, because for me, every time I get a script come through, it's like opening a box with a gift inside. And that's the pleasure for me, is not knowing what this is going to require or offer me or delight me with. It's like a lovely surprise every time.
Thank you for bringing to life books for those of us who are print disabled, and I wish you many, many more years of doing the same.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, hello. My name is Gordon Griffin, and I've recorded, I should check out, I think it's something like 880, that's it, 880 audiobooks. No. Yes, 880 audiobooks, yeah. Yes. I started with audiobooks a long time, in the very, very early days when there were only two audiobook companies recording, not counting RNIB. Now, I came to RNIB fairly late, about, I would say, 20 years ago. Then I started to... I applied to them, and I asked to audition, and thank goodness I passed the audition. And since then, I record on a fairly regular basis. Whenever I can, I will record for them, yes.
And is there a book that really stands out as one that you're particularly proud of recording?
Oh, that's so hard. There are so many. There was one book called Oxygen by Andrew Miller, which won me lots and lots of awards, and I had a great soft spot for that. I also love doing the audiobook of Billy Elliot because it's my story. I come from the Northeast. My granddad was a miner. And so when I was growing up in the 1950s in the Northeast, people were, and I'd say, I want to be an actor. They'd say, don't be ridiculous, you can't be an actor with a Geordie accent. And so I very much identified with Billy Elliot. And I don't know, it's wonderful recording the great writers like Dickens and Thackeray, and I did George Orwell's 1984. I mean, these are great, great books. I did Homer's Odyssey. Fantastic books for an actor to do. But what I like particularly about what I do is that I don't know what I'm going to be doing next. So somebody will say, we'd like you to record this book. And I say, yeah, great. I don't even know what the book is going to be. And that's what's exciting. The challenge is having no idea what I'm going to be recording until I get the book.
And if I could offer you any book under the sun to narrate, is there one that you would leap upon?
One of the downsides of being someone who records lots and lots of books, I know what the next five books I'm going to be recording are, for example. So I get very little chance to actually record books for my own pleasure. Not that I don't get pleasure from recording books, of course. One book that I did enjoy tremendously was Captain Corelli's Mandolin. I kept hoping that someone was going to ask me to record that. It's a huge, spectacular book, very funny, incredibly moving, and I would love to have done that, but somebody else got the gig, unfortunately. But I would have liked to. I'd like to have done that.
Just before I left, I bumped into one of my favourite narrators of all times, Laurence Bouvard. Laurence, how have you been?
I've been terrific, thank you. It's lovely to see you.
And what have you been working on recently?
Oh, I've been working on a slew of books. I've got four on at the moment, but I have just finished working on a fantastic series by a woman called Haley Edwards. And it's the Bayou Born series about the four women of the apocalypse. And it's fantastic. It's got sexy dragons, it's got adorable, cuddly demons, and really evil archangels. So, like, what's not to like? Oh, and it's set in the South, so I get to use my Southern accent, too.
And have you got your next R&IB recording lined up as well?
I do. I am there in 3 weeks to do a book called In the Cut, which I'm very excited about. It's a mystery, I believe, but I haven't quite got to that manuscript yet because I have three more before that, so ask me in 2 weeks.
Could you ever have believed how popular audiobooks would become?
I'm surprised, but I'm delighted because I do think it's important because it gets the printed word out to a bunch of different people, some of whom may not have the reading skills or the attention span or the time. And I read an article recently which said that listening and reading are processed in the same way by our brain. So listening to audiobooks is brain healthy.
And actually, I think it means that people are reading, listening to far more books than they were before.
Absolutely. I think it's opened up a whole range of books to people because you can listen when you're in your car, you can listen when you're running, you can listen when you're putting your kids to sleep. And it helps time-starved people and people who just would rather listen than crack open a very big book.
So, if I could offer you any book in the world to record, what would it be?
I think it would have to be the Wizard of Oz series because I grew up with them. And there's more than just one. There's about 15. And they are the most magical, fabulous, fabulous books. And lots of opportunities for amazing voices.
Give us a witch's cackle.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
Laurence Bouvard, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the party.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to all the narrators, producers and support staff who work so hard to bring audiobooks to life, both at R&IB and commercially. Do you have a favourite narrator you'd like us to feature? Or perhaps you've got a favourite audiobook that you'd like to tell us about? Why not drop us a line via our email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Love books? Well, R&IB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print, and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Andy Stanton is the author of many children's books, including the Mr. Gum series. Here he is with the books of his life. Andy, is there a book from childhood or your teenage years that made you fall in love with reading?
Yeah, I remember taking a book called The 18th Emergency by Betsy Byers from the library when I was about eight, and I can still see myself reading it in one sitting in the kitchen back home. And The 18th Emergency is just a brilliant book, really funny, but emotional as well, very bittersweet. And it just taught me that a story doesn't have to be a huge thing about everything in the world exploding or whatever. It can just be as small a story as a boy at school who thinks he's in trouble with the school bully. Fantastic kids' book.
The pigeons flew out of the alley in one long swoop and settled on the awning of the grocery store. A dog ran out of the alley with a torn crackerjack box in his mouth. Then came the boy. The boy was running hard and fast. He stopped at the sidewalk, looked both ways, saw that the street was deserted, and kept going. The dog caught the boy's fear, and he started running with him. The two of them ran together for a block. The dog's legs were so short he appeared to be on wheels. His crackerjack box was hitting the sidewalk. He kept glancing at the boy because he didn't know why they were running. The boy did. He didn't even notice the dog beside him on the trail of spilled crackerjack behind. Suddenly, the boy slowed down, went up some steps, and entered an apartment building. The dog stopped. He sensed that the danger had passed, but he stood for a moment at the bottom of the steps. Then he went back to eat the crackerjacks scattered on the sidewalk and to snarl at the pigeons who'd flown down to get some. Inside the building, the boy was still running. He went up the stairs three at a time, stumbled, pulled himself up by the banister, and kept going until he was safely inside his own apartment. Then he sagged against the door. His mother was sitting on the sofa, going over some papers. The boy waited for her to look up and asked him what had happened. He thought she should be able to hear something was wrong just from the terrible way he was breathing. "Mom," he said, "just a minute. I gotta get these orders straight."
The 18th Emergency by Betsy Byers is available commercially in print and from RNIB in Braille, giant print, and is talking book number 7501, read by Anthony Higginson. Is there a book you go back to again and again on a rainy day?
I love to read all sorts of books, from quite highbrow, if I've still got the concentration, to, you know, just more populist. And the author who's given me the most pleasure of anyone over the years is Stephen King. I think his best book is The Stand. Everything King wrote in the 70s and 80s to me is just absolute compelling, brilliant storytelling. And I've been really delighted to meet so many authors in my time as an author and find that we've all got such admiration of Stephen King, because he just, you cannot put the book down. You have to see what happens next. So The Stand by Stephen King.
For the next hour and a half of that morning, yesterday morning, Nick knocked on doors and rang bells. There would be someone, well, he told himself. He himself felt all right, and surely he could not be the only one. There would be someone, a man, a woman, maybe a teenager with a learner's permit, and he or she would say, "Oh, hey, yes, let's get them to Camden. We'll take the station wagon," or words to that effect. But his knocking and ringing were answered less than a dozen times. The door would open to the length of a latch chain. A sick but hopeful face would look out, see Nick, and hope would die. The face would move back and forth in negation, and then the door would shut. If Nick could talk, he would have argued, if they could still walk, they could drive, that if they took his prisoners to Camden, they could go themselves, and there would be a hospital. They would be made well. But he couldn't speak. Some asked if he had seen Dr. Soames. One man, in a delirious rage, threw the door of his small ranch house wide open, staggered out on the porch, dressed only in his underpants, and tried to grab Nick. He said he was going to do what I should have done to you back in Houston. He seemed to think Nick was someone named Jenner. He lurched back and forth along the porch after Nick like a zombie in a third-rate horror picture. At last he crashed to the porch, and Nick watched him from the lawn below, his heart thumping rapidly. The man shook his fist weakly, then crawled back inside, not bothering to shut the door.
Our old friend Gary Kagan reading The Stand by Stephen King, which is talking book number 11694, and it runs for 54 hours and 10 minutes. It's also available in Braille and giant print. And is there something you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
I'd love to say something more contemporary, but I actually recently read The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck, and it's just the most brilliant document of the Depression, the American Depression. And the brilliant thing about Steinbeck is that he uses very, very simple language, and he just recombines it, very simple words, very simple ideas, until the most simple words and ideas become statements of great profundity. And it's just The Grapes of Wrath is it's my recommendation.
To the red country and part of the gray country of Oklahoma, the last rains came gently, and they did not cut the scarred earth. The plows crossed and recrossed the rivulet marks. The last rains lifted the corn quickly and scattered weed colonies and grass along the sides of the road, so that the gray country and the dark red country began to disappear under a green cover. In the last part of May, the sky grew pale, and the clouds that had hung in high puffs for so long in the spring were dissipated. The sun flared down on the growing corn day after day until a line of brown spread along the edge of each green bayonet. The clouds appeared and went away, and in a while they did not try any more. The weeds grew darker green to protect themselves, and they did not spread any more. The surface of the earth crusted, a thin, hard crust, and as the sky became pale, so the earth became pale. Pink in the red country and white in the gray country.
The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB21683, read by Michael Fitzpatrick. Andy Stanton, thank you so much.
My pleasure, thank you.
Thanks to Robert and to Andy Stanton. A wide range of Andy's books, including the Mr. Gum series, is available from the RNIB Library. For more details, search their website, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.